work and sacrifice can be miserable, but the long-term health of the individual, it takes work. Yeah. And sometimes that's not easy. And just because it's easy doesn't mean it's good.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, you could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the first season of Change Agents. What you may have noticed during season one is that the format of the interviews is very focused. It's carefully edited to focus on the guests, the issues, and of course their solutions. But we do not want to miss out on the opportunity to share with you, the viewers, some extended interviews from season one, from some of our favorite conversations. So today, please enjoy this extended interview with the one and only Evan Hafer. We fucking know it's our show.
It's our fucking show.
Are you joining us for the episode? I like it.
Yeah, you just great.
That's fine.
Lay down. Down. She doesn't know that one yet, so she's going to sit there.
How is she a TSA dog for 2 years and doesn't know down? This is basically what she did for the TSA right
here. She worked for the TSA.
We were kicking around ideas, and that's why I asked you yesterday about Black Rifle and your total headcount versus the number of veterans that you have working for you. Do you know of any other companies that have like a 50% employment rate of veterans?
Yeah, typically it would be a military contractor. So,
but what about at scale? Like, you guys are at a scale, like
we can find
a company that has two people and one of them is like, oh, 50%? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking scale.
Yeah, well, Raytheon might be a good example. And I don't know if they're 50% or Northrop Grumman, Raytheon. A service-related or technology-related industry that directly services the military, because they're recruiting out of there based on technical skills that people have learned in the military. But outside of, I would say like a... outside of that, I think that there's, from a commercial perspective, like a commercial corporation that's a brand, no. There's nobody else.
And so with that, why I thought of you is the issue that I have seen firsthand, probably struggle with in and of myself, military members transitioning out of service and finding out what is next, or not being able to find out what is next, not being able to move beyond the military industrial complex and they go contract forever. Or how many friends that we both have that like hung up one set of spurs and just went to work for some alphabet soup, fill in the blank, for a day rate. And then they're 60 and they wonder why they can't have a conversation with anybody, because they have absolutely no integration ability to society, because they've lived in that world forever. So that was...
You just named 90% of my friends.
It's like 92% of mine as well. Yeah. And again, I'm not saying I haven't struggled with these issues. I think one of the biggest things that actually helped me was geographic separation. And I'm curious your thoughts on that, because it's definitely a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. For the suicide rates that I've seen from people from the spec ops community, it's actually higher when they geographically separate, but I'm also seeing a higher level of success with people being able to redefine themselves and find something else to do outside of their previous job. Mm-hmm. So it kind of cuts both ways. But before we even get into that, you got to at least tell the story of Black Rifle Coffee and where it comes from and your military history.
Sure. I think just like anything, right? The mother of all invention is necessity. So first you have to say, I invented coffee. And then from there, you know, we can go on to talk about it.
How you refined
it. Yeah. the entire genesis of it is really simple. I was working in Iraq at the time. I was working for Alphabet Soup, and I was looking for a subscription coffee that I could get delivered to Mosul or Kirkuk at the time. That's where it was.
Were you always a coffee nerd though?
Oh yeah, from 97. So 97, I was in Seattle for a quarter at the University of Washington. And
one whole quarter
before I realized that, like, working at the night shift at UPS and getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and doing, you know, PT for ROTC, like, those are things that are not conducive to good grades. But I did love Seattle. Like, notice I said loved in past tense, because I think you've taken a beautiful city and, like, just completely trashed it, but that's my own personal perspective. 97 single origin micro lot coffees were, there's very few people doing that. And there were very few people that were really doing great espresso. There was one shop up in Capitol Hill, and there's a very fairly famous guy, if you're a Seattle coffee guy in Seattle, Mark Schumann, I believe, he wrote The Art of Espresso. And he had a book, he's done a couple different editions in that, but he started a coffee cart as a coffee cart in Capitol Hill in Seattle, Vivace, straight up.
Okay.
And to this day, like, this guy is the, like, what I would say is the father of American espresso in the United States. He's incredible. I think he has three different coffee shops now in Seattle. I fell in love with espresso there on Capitol Hill from drinking his espresso. Now, before that, I was pursuing a barista, and so I started pretending that I liked espresso initially.
You were working as a barista?
No, I was pursuing a female espresso, a barista. And
so the true motivation behind almost everything in life, a man
true
pursuing
motivation woman. Is technically, I was like, I was literally pretending that I was like, oh yeah, I love espresso. I could barely stomach the shit. And I went back and forth, trying to, you know, not only try the espresso, but more appropriately date her. And I ended up dating her, and I ended up liking espresso. But when I found real espresso, was Vivace in Capitol Hill in 97. And that's when...
Do you remember the first one?
Absolutely.
Really?
Abso-fucking-lutely, yeah. It was like perfection. And it still is to this day. To this day, when I go back to Seattle and drink his espresso, it's the perfect espresso.
Do you wear a Black Rifle coffee shirt when you order it, though, or a hat, perhaps?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I had one in Missoula 2 days ago. I had an espresso, Vivace espresso, because there's a French bakery in Missoula.
Okay.
La Petite, and I took Jericho there because it's one of my favorite places around the Inland Northwest. There, so if we rewind, we say, I know every incredible spot to get espresso in the Inland Northwest all the way over to Seattle, that as far as like early 2000s till today, there is not one coffee shop that somebody can tell me exists. If they serve a great espresso, there's fucking no way I haven't been there. Like, there's no way. And more importantly, there's no way I probably know their boss. And growing up in, I think, in that scene, for a lack of a better term, I was into coffee from late 90s and then early 2000s. I didn't see, obviously, just like most of us didn't see the global war on terror coming, right? And it wasn't as if we didn't know there wasn't terrorists out there. We knew that. I always looked at this as, hey, I'm going to get out of college, I'm going to go jump out of airplanes and learn a second language and, you know, maybe get into some low intensity conflict somewhere as a Green Beret, but I'm going to go be a coffee guy. Like, that's what I was doing from the beginning. From 2000, being a Green Beret was more of just a recreational pause in my professional development. It was not meant to be a lifetime endeavor.
I don't think it says that on the recruiting posters. Yeah. Would you like a recreational pause in your professional Join the Green Berets, travel the world.
Travel the world. You know, I thought it was like, you know, at the time I was, because for me it was more about having this adventure of life. Like if you're reading your own story, and if you're opening up a book to your own story, what do you want it to sound like? What do you want it to read like? And for me, being able to you know, looking back from late 90s saying, oh, I'm gonna go jump into, and at that time, you know, there's a lot of Vietnam stuff out there. I'm gonna jump into the jungles. I'm gonna train, you know, host indigenous forces to overthrow a country. That's pretty high adventure, right?
Comparatively, yeah. For the time, yeah.
Yeah. You know, outside of like, you know, a life of crime, I don't know how else you would find that much danger and excitement. There's really not a lot. In technically speaking, you are overthrowing a country, which is somewhat illegal and frowned upon depending on the country that you're overthrowing.
Only if you live there.
Yeah. So I was always coming back to coffee. It was never a doubt in my mind.
Were you always going to come back and have a coffee company, or did you, that idea kind of formed over time?
No, my idea has always been the same, which was like having a 12 kilo roaster in a shop in either a neighborhood or a smaller town where you talk to and interface with the community every day, and you pull incredible shots, espresso shots, you can do pour overs and talk to people. It's never changed. It's always been the same. Black Rifle is actually the first concept, and what I wanted was to have a bougie coffee shop range where you could buy highly custom STIs and like, you know,
wear a scarf and have an espresso.
Like an ascot. Yeah. And my wife had a coffee shop in Denver. So kind of fast forwarding, I met my wife. She had a coffee shop in Denver. I had been roasting coffee since 2005, just recreationally.
When you met your wife, had you already transitioned out of military to the Alphabet Soup?
No, I was still in Alphabet Soup. She thought I worked for Northrop Grumman or something like that. I can't remember. And we were planning on starting a shop earlier than that with another guy that actually still works for Black Rifle. His name's Edwin Parnell. We had been looking at different properties in Colorado to start a shop. I met my wife, the Alphabet Soup guys met my wife. And then we looked at different places in Colorado early on. Like this was like 2014, 2012.
What do you think you would have called it? Or had you already kind of had the Black Rifle idea?
Well, I did. It was Espresso Smiths. So it was Coffee Smiths and Espresso Smiths. Like at that time, everything was, for me, I kept looking at the anvil from, there's a clothing and apparel company, or they did bags, forget what, it's like backpacks and stuff like that. And they used to have an anvil on it. You guys remember what that was called?
It a Seattle company?
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck, it is right on the tip of my tongue. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Mountain Smith.
Yep.
So I was thinking about it from the Mountain Smith perspective, and I was looking at it from like Coffee Smith's, Espresso Smith. And my wife, she had a little apparel company called Metal, because her last name was Bar Mettler. And so she had like TM'd Metal. And I was like, oh, cool. So we kind of kicked around a bunch of different names early on, and Espresso Smiths, Coffee Smiths. But we were like, man, we're kind of like these old, we're commandos, right? Or technically speaking, working within that professional track. We're not fucking hipster weirdos that are, you know, curating these experiences. We don't really know a lot about it. We just know what we like. And we didn't have any real capital for startup. So I started roasting coffee and selling it online. And Black Rifle was the condition of the circumstance. And like every, you know, the mother of invention is necessity. I was on the range working for the CIA, and I had my service rifle and a little 1 pound, it's called a fluid bed coffee roaster, which is basically a high grade popcorn popper. So I was roasting coffee on the back tailgate of a government truck, and I had a little, my short barreled rifle that I was throwing around. So, and technically speaking, so I'm a coffee guy. That's what I want to do. Like, I'm still in my like recreational phase of professional development, like working for the CIA. But I'm also training and teaching them, former special operations guys, to come and work for the CIA. And I'm one of the most highly competent, this isn't me saying it, like patting myself on the back. I'm one of the most highly proficient and competent shooters in special operations. So at the time, I'm working at a place where even the selection criteria were dropping guys from tier one units. And I'm in the 1% of the 1% for shooting and CQB. So I'm a coffee guy that's technically one of the fastest guns with a fucking sound stupid. But that's what it is, truly. So black rifle and then coffee, that is the genesis. I used to shoot the rifle qual for our selection against guys from other tier one units with my pistol, just to piss them off.
And then roast coffee in your off time.
Well, because I'm like, you know, I'm a 5'7", 160 pounds on a good day. You know, I like fucking weird. I like weird stuff, man. Like, you know, I read books and I roast coffee and I run rivers and, you know, I don't fit in and conform completely to the commando subculture. So you also have to like beat the shit out of them, their egos, by just beating them.
Well, they won't pay attention until you do.
You have to give them a big scoop of humble pie.
Yeah.
Or they won't listen to you. So you have to just really kind of beat them into submission through performance for them to actually listen to you. So you have to be good.
That checks out.
It checks out. You have to. Like, you're not going to listen to some dude talk about CQB unless he's better at CQB than you.
This is a true story. I've sat there and watched that try to go down, and it's a slow motion train wreck that I can't pull my eyes away from.
So you put people in a sim house, and that's what I used to always do. Put people into a simunition house and put them into scenarios, and you'd film how effed up they are. And then you'd play that back to them and go, but this is me and this is you. You look like a big pile of steaming trash. I do pretty good. Look at this. I didn't die, you did. Weird. Well, that's not the way it works. If I was, you know, in a street fight, you know, that's how that comes. But in a street fight, that's where I would bite. You know, I see red. I see red. I'd go in, but it's like, bro, you sat at the threshold in the middle of your, you know, in the center of the door, mouth breathing for 3.5 seconds and didn't engage targets. Why? Right? So you'd have to like point that out to them and be like, you look like a steaming pile of liquid shit. And then they'd be like, oh yeah, but this is me engaging with target as I cross the threshold. Like, you'd be like, weird how that works. Yeah. I don't know. Didn't see the scenario before.
One of you survives, one of you does not.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first online sale you made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I profiled Just Black, which is our first coffee, which is with, it has my service rifle, my short barrel rifle. It's a 12 inch.
12 inch is good though.
12 inch. It's a 12 inch piston LWRC with a suppressor. You know, at the time, that's what I was using. So I called it Just Black because that was the coffee that I drank every day and that was the gun that I carried every day.
And so you were roasting that, bagging that, selling that all you?
I was selling it in the restaurant up in Moscow.
Okay.
Under a different name, but that's what it was. It's 2008 is when I profiled it. And then I went to Afghanistan in 2012. That's when I profiled AK-47 Espresso because that's what the guys were carrying. I was shooting them every day, but I wasn't carrying them because I just couldn't bring myself to do that.
It's not my favorite weapons platform.
No, it's like, Now, if I would have modified it, maybe, but like it's just sloppy and slow. Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know. I would modify it by throwing it in a ditch and picking up my normal service rifle. Fuck. Yeah. Sigs are trash. They do run, though. There's nothing that can stop them.
No, yeah. I mean, who wants to drive a lawn tractor across the United States? It runs.
Yeah.
Like, what's going to be more fun, a Ferrari or a lawn tractor?
Depends.
I'm just saying.
Are we on-road or off-road?
Yeah, off-road, yeah.
Probably a Ferrari. It's not going to get as far. So how did it start growing? When did it really take off? And I'm assuming you came to a place where you had to choose between what you were doing, you know, training guys.
Well, I got fired, so that was that was the biggest thing.
That also helps.
Yeah, it helps. It's more of like a forcing function to what your professional development track. So at that time, my professional recreation was over, which was okay with me, because I was like, to be fair, I was probably 2 years overcooked, and they should have fired me like 2 years before that for all the horrible shit that I would say to people all the time. And I didn't want to work there anymore. Like I was looking for a way out way before that. I was burnt out. I had 43 deployments, you know, 7 years of my life were deployed, you know, into glorious places. I was burnt out. I was toxic. Like I will say that, like I was, like, I was burnt out with the bureaucracy.
Did you realize it at the time, or you just say that looking back?
I realized it, and subconsciously, I was trying to get, like, and I realized it even at the time. I was like, if I get fired, I don't give a shit. Like, I used to tell people that all the time. I'm like, get rid of me. You can't, can you? So eventually that steam has caught up. Eventually somebody will say, we got you. All right, yeah. Man. Yeah, we got you. But yeah, I was trying really hard, like, to get somebody to tell me. It's kind of like for me, when you have a toxic relationship, you know you need to get out of it, and you're just an asshole to your partner. Because you want them to break up with you.
Yeah, you don't want to do it yourself. You just start dragging your feet on everything. Yeah,
that's exactly what I did. So for like 2 years, I was just like really toxic, like a very bad partner. And
what is she doing?
Here, 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 here. What are you doing? Sit.
Bro.
Sit, sit, sit. There you go. What is she doing, jumping around?
She's having the time of her life.
Sit. So I think I was in this toxic relationship with a partner. We were both like, what I always tell people is like, just because you get divorced doesn't mean that both parties are bad. It means you're just bad together. And so I was bad for those years. And then it was time for me to move on. And so when I transitioned into the next endeavor, it was mainly about how do I pay my mortgage without carrying a rifle for a living anymore. But I knew what I wanted to do. It was like, great, I'm gonna do coffee. My wife had a coffee shop. I had I was roasting coffee.
Did you know, like, Matt, JT, mm-hmm. Logan, all of them at this time, you guys had already kind of met?
I met Matt while working at the agency, because we were introduced to each other by somebody else that worked at the agency that was in 2nd Ranger Battalion with him. And once I met him, and then those guys kind of, they showed me that you could be successful from making stupid videos. And I realized, I was like, if these idiots can be successful making videos for the internet, well,
which is the exact description of what they were doing.
Correct. So what if we took like their ability to make stupid videos and my ability to make coffee and put those three things together, we might be able to make a living out of this. Like their ability to make stupid videos and my ability to make great coffee. Okay, so we just did that.
Did it just take off like a rocket ship?
Yeah, I mean, our first year we did 1.37 million out of my garage. So I was roasting coffee and bagging coffee out of my garage. It was just me and my wife. So Jared was mainly doing the video work. Matt was kind of lukewarm. He wasn't in on it, like, to begin with. But then our second year, we did $8 million in gross, and that's when Matt was like, yeah.
Less lukewarm.
Huh. This looks like it might be a pretty good deal.
Just sit back.
What if I were to make stupid videos and make more money? We could do more over there. We could make like stupid videos. We could generate more revenue. We could pay our mortgages. So initially it was just, how do we pay our mortgages? That was like, you know, our first year was 1.3, second year was 8, our third year was 16. We doubled again.
And that's then, crazy.
You know, fourth year was like 32, 64. We just doubled every year.
When did you start drastically adding headcount?
Year 3. And year 3, I realized it went from we're making stupid videos and kind of trolling people on the internet, which we still do. We do a lot less, but because that was mainly what we were doing. We're like, let's troll a certain percentage of people on the internet. Let's have fun with those people. Let's make fun of them. And let's just put really good coffee behind it. Where the inflection point came was we had a real opportunity to hire vets. And we had been really involved, obviously, in the veteran subculture and a lot of the 501s and nonprofits involving, you know, trauma, head injuries, injuries just in general. And I was reading all this data on under or unemployed veterans. And so I was looking at data, and you're looking at suicide rates, you're looking at the under unemployed, and then the people that just are transitioning out, going into full-time retirement and essentially not entering the workforce. Well, when you're 30, 35, you know, 25, and you're not entering the workforce.
Even if you do a full 20, like I joined it shortly after 18. I signed the paperwork at 17, joined at 18. Let's say I did a full 20.
Mm-hmm.
That's only 38.
Yeah.
That's 7 years ago for me. I can't even fathom, like, here I am. I've done what I did, and now I don't know what the hell I would do with my time.
Well, and that to me, I think, is a direct path where looking at underemployment and unemployment in the veteran community and looking at suicide rates and then psychological health, like just health and stability in general, and then talking to people within the subculture, combining those aspects or those pieces of data with your conversations with your peer group as to why are people so unhappy, we realized we had an opportunity. We could directly impact the veteran community through hiring. And the big thing is, you know, I'm not the brightest guy. Like, you know, I'm fairly blunt depending on the project, but I'm very much like lead by example. I don't really give a shit about what people say, you know, especially in this era of social media of like hot air horse shit where people are talking all, you know, private jets and Rolexes and Rolls Royces and all this. Just it's fictional materialistic crap. It doesn't hold any substance in your life as far as like, that's great you're on a private jet, it's great you're on a Rolls Royce, but you might be the most unhappy person and you're ready to like blow your head off tomorrow.
And you might just be a total piece of shit.
Well, and it doesn't make you a good person.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make you ethically, it doesn't make you an ethical person. It doesn't make you a good father. It doesn't make you a good friend. It doesn't make you a good man. You can be just a complete waste of oxygen. And so you have this, you know, all of these different things that people are pursuing from, I would say, a happiness perspective. And it's like the whole thing of like, find something you love and you'll never work another day in your life. Like these like fictionalized versions of life where people think that they can just not work and be a little bit miserable towards achieving a goal. It's like work and sacrifice can be miserable, but the long-term health of the individual, it takes work.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's not easy. And just because it's easy doesn't mean it's good. So I'm looking at, you know, underemployment, unemployment rates. I'm looking at the overall psychological health of the community. And then I'm saying we have an opportunity to lead by example, which I'm a big proponent of, versus just talking like hot air. And now I can go out and I can hire and build an ecosystem of support around the GWAP veteran. Because from my perspective, if I build a culture and a community around being able to have open and honest communication with each other around any and all things that you might be dealing with based on a physical condition or a psychological condition or a financial, whatever that might be, we can have those conversations within a company. And we have those conversations within a company. We have hallway conversations within the company around that. No other company in America, you can walk in and walk down the hall and say, you know what, I've been having a lot of like, yeah, here's a good example. We were talking about, this is for like Netflix or Amazon or something. Or
nobody knows.
YouTube, right? So we were talking about this the other day. We're talking about killing people, right? And, but we were talking about it from a long-term psychological health perspective as to what is it like to carry the weight of taking life. And all of us in this room, we're talking about the gravity of life, how heavy that is and how the long-term psychological effects of that can manifest in different ways. You couldn't have that conversation in another company in America because we're all talking about...
You could at your exit interview.
Yeah. HR would have been down there tomorrow, like within 15 minutes, but we were sitting there with my chief of staff, with the CHRO,
yeah,
and with a couple other people from the company, and you know, former Green Beret, former Navy, former this, former that, former, and we're having this really in-depth intellectual and emotional conversation around the long-term psychological effects of taking life. We were having that in the professional workplace. And it was one
you couldn't replicate that anywhere except for a place that was started with a ethos and background like the one that you had. Mm-hmm. It would be impossible anywhere else. And maybe that's one of the issues that veterans face that come from a combat arms perspective in those organizations. If they end up there, is they feel like they can't have that conversation.
They can't, and then they feel trapped. So when I get into what happens with a veteran, especially a combat arms veteran, I mean, typically you have a very small percentage of people that have actually pulled the trigger down range. It's very small. But then you have a bigger percentage of people that have been shot at, and you have, you know, a bigger percentage, yeah, of people obviously that have been deployed. But you have a separation from your tribe, so you have this like very interlocked community around mission first, you know, very specific as to your conditions and standards, your goals, conditions and standards. Then you remove that person from their tightly knit and connected tribe, and you take that person out and you put them into an isolated community. And when I look at this from professionally, this is the problem with a PC culture, a politically correct culture. That person has been doing the most politically incorrect thing as a professional endeavor their entire life. So you take you out of the military, you take me out of the military. Our entire job was putting people in the ground. And then now we're gonna go to work for Wells Fargo? And we think that's gonna work? It's not. It's not gonna work. It's a pipe dream. And then you wonder why people are integrating back into the professional workplace and they're underemployed or they're having psychological problems, especially when they're coming out of special operations, tier one, or combat arms units. It's because they don't have a landing pad. They're not okay in the context of, they can't just conform to the professional work environment. And the expectation they're going to is insane. For any politician, person in the VA, or general officer to assume that these guys are gonna make this transition out of what they were doing into the professional workforce and then go, I don't understand why the, you know, Dale's not fitting in it at Goldman Sachs. That's weird. Would have never guessed that. Oh, I can tell you why.
Yeah.
Because Dale has been making jokes about, like, taking an axe handle and putting it through somebody's skull for the last 10 years. And now he works at a place where he can't say the F word without somebody going to HR. And boy, talk about feeling isolated. Talk about feeling alone.
Good morning, everybody. As you know, Change Agents is an Ironclad original. But what you may not know is that for over a decade, Ironclad has worked with brands and individuals to create world-class films, series, podcasts, and ad campaigns. In fact, I've been working with Ironclad for the past few years. I was introduced to them on a project through the Navy SEAL Foundation. I've worked with them on a variety of projects, even up here in Montana, long before they proposed the idea of Change Agents to me. They're the best in their field. And I say that because there are plenty of people out there looking for the best, looking for the cream of the crop, looking for the top of the triangle. And if you're looking for that, you need to look no further than Ironclad. If you ever need media by way of film, a series, podcasts, or ad campaigns, they have you covered. You can reach out today and follow them anywhere at This Is Ironclad, the ampersand, and then This Is Ironclad, or visit them online, thisisironclad.com. Again, www.thisisironclad.com.
So how do we build those landing pads? So about 200,000 people a year get out of the military. Mm-hmm. I don't know your thoughts on it. You know, the boot camp in the Navy was 8 weeks long.
And it was the toughest 8 weeks of your life.
7 weeks and 6 days too long in my assessment for Navy boot camp. What's the Army? 8 to 10, 12?
Yeah, 16. Because you have basic training and then advanced individual training.
But it's whatever branch you're in, except for... Does Space Force have boot camp?
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
I know not much about Space Force, and I want to know more. But regardless, so let's say they do have a boot camp.
Yeah.
It takes you from a civilian, and it onboards you to the military system. How much time did you have for your offboarding from the military?
Well, I off-ramped. So I went from active duty back into the National Guard and then went into... contracting.
I mean, so in the Navy they have a program, and maybe they have it in the Army too. It was called TAPS, the Transition Assistance Program. Mm-hmm. I think it was 7 days, of which I showed up, and the guy goes, "You actually here? I'll sign your paperwork now. You can skip the rest of this."
Great.
Well, I had been messing around a little bit, so you know, my departure, I had about a year because I had to go through the PEB MEB board process. So I knew that they were at least looking at my record. I knew the likelihood was, hey, my military service career is going to come to an end of one of two ways. I'm either getting out on my own or you guys are going to medically retire me. But I had that year, so I started doing other things. So it was a little bit easier for me, but I don't know how many E8s, E9s I have seen in their 20th or 25th year. Like their EAS is months away, and they'll say things like, yeah, just getting ready to start my bachelor's. It's like, holy shit, man. And I guess my point in all that is there's a distinct process for onboarding. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will point at the military and say, well, you didn't do a very good job of offboarding me. And I don't know where I land on it. I don't actually think it's the military's job. I think the emphasis should fall onto the service member. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's right. That's currently kind of where I land right now, because it's just... The military is not a mechanism that puts a lot of emphasis on that portion of your career. And everybody knows that it's coming at some point in time. And to struggle beyond your service and say the military didn't invest enough, you know, transitioning me out, it's like, I don't know if they ever promised to. But I also don't know who should be responsible for building the landing pad. Like the fact that you could have a corporate conversation around the moral implications of taking life, I think a lot of people will hear that and go, that's such an unhealthy work environment. I hear you describe that conversation, like that's probably one of the healthiest conversations that those people could have. And it's directly correlated to their improved mental health because they feel comfortable having that conversation around their peers.
Well, they feel safe.
But I don't know how to build that in an environment where you don't have you know what I mean? You founded the company with your background and your experience. I don't know how to recreate that system in a place, just to use a blanket term that I know nothing about, but like Amazon.
I don't think you can. I think that you can try, and that's part of the lead by example, which is, I think if you have veteran entrepreneurs starting businesses, they're going to start, I would say, culturally inclined environments that can have these conversations and can, you know, growing a company and a culture around, especially GWAT, because obviously this is our, you know, our war. It goes back to, I don't think we can. So this is necessity is the mother of all invention. It goes back to, how do we build an army of entrepreneurs that are out there starting businesses, whether they're starting a lawn mowing service or, you know, electrical, you know, repair, whatever it might be, so they can have the opportunity to go out and hire and make the impact on the community the same way. So everything doesn't have to be at such massive scale. It just has to be something that we're actively looking at changing. I would say one entrepreneur, one person of influence at a time. I think the Army needs to do, when we look at the TAPS program or the military just in general, I think the longer you've been in, the longer they have to work on transitioning you out. Meaning, your job while you're in needs to be mission focused on what you're doing, not on what you're gonna do when you leave. And what guys need to do, and what the military I think does need to do, is they need to take ownership in this, is you don't want guys that are still in, that are committed to, I would say, the strategic goals and objectives of our national interest, to be focused on what they're doing when they're getting out.
Yeah, their weekend hustle.
Yeah, no. I think there needs to be, if you're in for four, that's 4 years, like, congratulations, like you did four. You know what I mean? But like, if you're in for four, maybe that's 30 days, right? It takes you 30 days to kind of get in this transition. But
pre-9/11, though, that was actually, I think, standard. I mean, it was like the GI Bill. It was this socioeconomic ladder that people mm-hmm. could go and leave where they're from and like, hey, I got college paid for afterwards.
But 20, you are professionally and culturally indoctrinated.
Yeah, you're brainwashed to a degree.
Correct. You need to have, I would say, a performance. And when I say that, it's you have to have a very specified timeline and goals associated with your transition out of the military into the professional workplace that are performance driven. And they have to do that. And the military owes you or whomever it is that time to do it, which is, you have 4 years. Let's just say you did 20, you have 4 years to transition out. And you have, you know, 2.5 left to get your bachelor's degree or whatever it is that you're gonna do. I think that's almost as if you need to have a transition battalion where you're now in transition battalion, learning to be a civilian because you have been professionally indoctrinated to be a killing machine. Put that into like the context of what people do. You can't go to work for Amazon. You're seen as a monster. Like, you can't go to work in Seattle. You can't go back to academia and look at, you know, going, I'm gonna sign into Columbia and start my degree in philosophy. If you think that you're not gonna wanna punch the professor of philosophy in the nose and break his face within the first 15 minutes, you're out to lunch. Like, there has to be, I think, goals and objectives associated with performance in transitioning a person out of the military, because it allows you to focus on what your mission is in the military and be the best at doing that and not worry about it. Versus if you're distracted and you're thinking about what you're gonna do when you leave, I think that takes away from mission success and, in some cases, I would say, critical objectives.
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
How has your experience been employing 50% vets? And we're talking,
it's hit and miss.
And we're talking hundreds of people.
Yeah, hundreds of people. It's hit and miss.
Do you expect more of them or the same as a traditional civilian hire?
Um, It's kind of a hard question, I guess, to answer. I've been woefully disappointed from people from the special operations community. They think that they're going to go to work in a civilian organization and the red carpets are going to be rolled out, and like, you know, because of your hat or because of your cool little badge that you got on your Navy uniform or whatever it is, that everybody's just going to bow down and.
Yeah, they're looking, you know, for their cape in their closet.
Yeah.
They get pissed when it's not in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you start telling them the world owes you nothing, like this is America, the world owes you nothing. You have to work for everything you get. And it's going to take, you know, a lot of discipline. There's a lot of guys that are like, but come on, man, I was a Green Beret. Like, what? That part of my life is over. You're like, no. And I have been disappointed in what I would say is not their level of performance, because honestly, a lot of these guys are really bright and they're dedicated. It's, they think they should be stepping into like a six-figure job where they're just automatically promoted to a vice president or a director because of, it said special on their shoulder.
Yeah.
Or because of somebody has lied to them for their entire professional career and said that they are so special and they're so elite that you automatically deserve a six-figure compensation as soon as you leave.
Well, they are special and elite, but it's in such a narrow band of an operational spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with what you should negotiate your salary based upon, unless they're asking you to do exactly what you were very special at,
mm-hmm.
in which case you'd have a great argument for this is my daily rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're a breacher. That's great.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to pay you a daily rate to be a professional breacher. That's great. You're trained to do that.
For the two now, people on earth that have that job.
If you can't run a group of, you know, technicians to push a website rebuild across the line because you have no technological proficiency, what value is it? So what I've found is they have to be more patient with the acceleration of their professional development. They have to really, one, they have to put in the time. Two, they also have to kind of work with where they can create the most value, not where they kind of want to create the most value. I think a lot of guys from the mill, they want to be in charge right away too. And like, it just doesn't work that way. It's like, You know, you didn't get to just like, you know, Glassman didn't promote you to the head of CrossFit as soon as you got out because you're a SEAL Team 6 guy.
No.
Like, you weren't like...
It would have been a mistake too, actually.
Yeah. Very big.
It's one of the biggest misconceptions, and it's one of the things that I dislike about so many individuals and organizations trying to replicate military leadership in the civilian world. They're leaving out, especially from the special operations community, they're mm-hmm. leaving out quite a few things that make leadership really fucking easy when you're a SEAL officer. And that is, these people have volunteered so many times and have been refined and trained and volunteered again and made it through selection process. So from like a 99th percentile, they're all bought in and facing in the correct direction. You have the highest performing team full of the highest performing individuals who want to do what you are asking them to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, I'm the best leader in the world. Then you go to a place, again, I don't know shit about Amazon, but I had a conversation recently with a guy who got out of the teams and was dropped in there as one of the advisors. And he's trying to ask a guy to do something. The guy just looks up at him and goes, yeah, I quit. Because he had had a bad, he's just like, this job,
a bad day.
This job isn't about who I am. I do this so I can pay my fucking car off mm-hmm. and my apartment and barely have enough money to eat ramen. I don't care what the mission statement is.
Okay.
I don't care. Mm-hmm. And you caught me on a bad moment. I quit.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen in the communities that we came from. So this is like, stand up and motivate and lead, all great things. We need to look at it from a different perspective and lens. if you take that approach in an environment with people that don't have the same level of buy-in, you're going to fall flat on your face.
Well, you know, and even to go back to the hiring and then the hiring from the percentage of veterans, it's a mixed bag, which where I was going to. It's like I've been really impressed with the level of cohesion and commitment to the mission. I've been under-impressed with, I would say, the some of the special operations guys that come from my community with their level of arrogance. And I've been really impressed with, I would say, the conventional military and their level of commitment to trying to get it, to work hard to get ahead. So it's interesting to see like my community and the from the special operations.
It's true. I think once you hit into that special operations pipeline, anytime you separate these groups, you're special.
You're special.
Yeah. Here's a different color beret for you,
yeah.
Which I don't know why you guys chose a painting hat. That's a different conversation, but we chose a nice like Liberace pin, mm-hmm. you know, made out of gold. Super weird, but people look at it and they, but here's the thing, and I'm sure on Army bases, if you're wearing a green beret, people give you a second look, they treat you differently. Same thing with the trident.
Yeah.
It's the only naval insignia that's gold for both enlisted and officers. It's like another thing that people take a look at and you get used to that shit and you can't carry that beyond your military service. I mean, do you see people struggling to let go of their past and their previous identity?
Oh, absolutely. I see it as definitive baggage for professional development. And if you, one of the things that I continue to tell people is like, you have to sacrifice your ego on the altar of business. And the way you do that is you have to kill your previous profession and any associated identity that you've had with it. In the context of, just because I was a Green Beret doesn't mean I'm gonna succeed as a businessman. It has no relevance. Now, I can utilize portions of my experience of doing that in order to succeed in business, but I can't say statistically it's going to increase the probability of me succeeding.
It might decrease it, actually.
Exactly. So if we collectively understand that we have to kill portions of our ego in order to succeed, and then offload the professional identity, because when we have too many attachments to our professional identity, we've assigned a lot of what we might do in the future based on the success we've had in the past. And just because you're you know, a good example is just because you're really good at, you know, running through a house and shooting people in the face doesn't mean you're going to be a great project manager, you know, improving supply chain and logistics. It doesn't have any.
Or great in a boardroom, perhaps receiving some slightly negative feedback.
No, yeah. And they want to hang on to that so desperately. And to me, that's a liability, because if you want to develop professionally, what you have to do is you have to assign your success criteria to your new profession, and you have to offload your previous identity. You can be proud of it. You can keep it in your shadow box and talk about it, but that's not what you lead with.
Yeah.
You know, like in SF, right? They guys love their De Oppresso Labor rings that they wear around. And I intentionally don't have any of that stuff, like ever. Like, I intentionally have none of it. Because I don't want people to see it. I don't want people to see it and assume, like, I don't care about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I have a big ring and it says De Oppresso Labor, you know, just because I could free the oppressed at one point in my career, I don't like jewelry, but two, I just think it's kind of ridiculous.
And well, why wear a ring when you can get it wrapped on your car?
Well, you know, and one of my favorite...
Under
a Punisher skull. One of my favorite memories was this guy that I met from your old unit, and he had a giant, like a giant Western belt buckle.
Tell me it was a tribe.
Giant. Like this dude.
Like a dinner plate.
It looked like a WWF, like belt buckle, right? Like it was that big. Snakeskin boots, giant belt buckle with a trident right in the middle of it. Then a trident ring on top of it, snakeskin matching holster with a 1911, and tridents on the 1911, and
in case somebody hadn't seen it on the belt buckle,
in case he hadn't seen it on the ring or the belt buckle or heard him in any conversation, because every 5 minutes it was like, I was a SEAL, I was a SEAL, I was a SEAL.
Yeah.
Quite possibly one of the most tactically improficient people I've ever worked with in my life, to include wore cowboy boots on target, which was like unbelievable.
I didn't know that you worked with Goggins.
So, this guy, unbelievably awesome. But I just remember thinking that, I'm like, man, this guy is so attached to what he did in his past. He will not be able to succeed in the future because he's putting more effort into what he did 2 years ago than he wants to do in 2 years from now.
They're like an icebreaker, and you're watching it from like a static drone shot as it goes. And what those people don't realize who have that persona and everything is about who they used to be, is that if you watch that vessel just go and the ripples keep going out, that's the impact that that persona has on everybody around them. Because it's off-putting and people are just like, ugh. Ooh. And for most people, they've never met a fill in the blank. And then that's the person that you meet, and it has a very long-lasting and cascading impact on everybody else. They're like, ooh, I only have a data point of one and I didn't enjoy that, so I'm actually not interested in being around that anymore. It can close doors for people from those communities because that person is so attached. It's all that they are and all that they can talk about.
I always hate meeting guys like that where they're not stolen valor, you know, where you're like, oh, there's no way that guy's stolen valor. And then you talk to him like, oh, man, he is. He's actually from that unit. Golly, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, but if it would be so much easier if you just stolen valor, then I could just call you out. But that's not.
Yeah, because they don't take the whole, hey, you should shut the fuck up conversation very well.
No, because they're like, well, but I really was that guy. And you're like, ugh. Anyway.
What advice do you have for employers when it comes to hiring vets?
There's two things. I think it depends on the size of your company, right? So if you have a small company, you can make a big impact. You have a small company, you know, one person might be the COO, the CFO, the HR, like they're doing everything, right? So when you're hiring vets, I think the thing that you have to realize is like veterans are human beings just like everybody else. They are prone to mistakes and they have failures and they have a complete professional background that has led them to that point. They have to be assessed like every other person. So just assuming that because they're a veteran means they're great, it's a bad assumption. Not all veterans are created equal, just like everybody else, right? So don't give people a pass just because they served. You have to interview them. You have to put them through the ringer. You have to, you know, make sure they're the right fit for the job. I've seen this happen a lot with small businesses. They'll say, he was a vet. And then they auger in. You're like, but that guy, he went to basic training and failed out and he got a dishonorable discharge. It's not a vet, man. Like, it's not. Or, you know, he was a special operations guy, so he's going to be great. No. I've seen that go wrong 1,000 times.
Yeah.
So you still have to do the work. Don't assume that whomever you're hiring, just because they're a vet, they're gonna be exceptional. That's just not the case. You still have to do the work. Number two, if you're a company at scale and you have a bigger department, assign somebody to be your veteran recruiter, the veteran HR representative, the person that's out there beating the drum for the company every day, because that person will ultimately be not only recruiting, but then disseminating information, communicating internally and externally, like you can really make a big impact, not only from pulling people in, but also the continuation of the employment of veterans throughout the organization. Number three, skill bridge is a thing. You know, they're named different things for different units, but the military has done a really good job in the last couple of years of activating programs where guys transitioning off active duty can come to work, and they will pay them their previous active duty salary to come to work for you.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, seek opportunities through the VA or some of those in order to go out and hire vets. But if people are really interested in it, they really just have to dig in. They got to roll up their sleeves and dig in. Start with your recruiting, start with your retention, then go out and see how you can expand the programs. But we've been able to make a huge dent, I think, just in the last five years. So we went from underemployment rate being about 2% above the national average as a peer group, as a veteran peer group, to now we're about 2% below. Now, whether or not that's just because people are completely off the market, it's a different data point that we'd have to look at. But I've talked to a substantial amount of people, whether it's a CEO of Home Depot or bigger CEOs that have made this a very specific goal associated with their company to go out and hire veterans. So I've seen a big impact and shift. When people make this a priority, it will make a national impact. It will absolutely make, it will make big impact as far as like the professional organizations, corporate organizations.
What advice do you have to the veterans?
My advice to veterans is, well, I would say from my advice to veterans from multiple points, number one, your background gets your foot in the door. It doesn't mean that it allows you the opportunity to work there forever, right? So just because you're a vet doesn't mean that they have to keep you employed forever. Like, you have to work hard every day for your position on the team is what I like to call it. Two, you gotta kill your ego. Like, you really do. Like, there's a lot of people that attachment to their previous identity, which they should be proud of, is great, but they really have to just slay the dragon in that regard. Like, try hard to professionally integrate, work with your peers, not assume that you know more because, you know, you carried a saw in Ramadi or wherever it was. So kill your ego, listen. And then I would say the fourth is take all the things that you've learned in leadership and management, and try to provide structure to the business organization, because that ultimately is the real value that people from the military bring. It's not because they were, you know, a javelin gunner or whatever it was. Like, that doesn't have zero professional relevance. It's they've had real leadership, real management experiences that they can apply to business and projects to get things across the line in a way that will quite literally create exceptional value in the organization. So if they did those things, they were, you know, sacrifice their ego at the door of the business, work hard to professionally integrate to their peer group, and then really work hard to apply leadership and management that they've learned in the military to the organization, they're gonna succeed. Like, I have no doubt.
Hope you enjoyed the episode today. If you want to learn more about the BRCC Fund, please go to brccfund.org. And if you want to, you can make a donation, or you could just search the website and find out about more of the individuals and organizations that the fund has partnered with, such as the First Command Education Foundation, Candorful, and many others. You can also follow the BRCC Fund on Instagram at BRCC Fund. See you guys next time.